Several of you have asked, so I wanted to tell you this morning as we're going through this study called A Survey of Church History. Several of you have asked what material I'm going to be using. And I was going to put it up on a slide this morning, but I forgot to do that. There is a book, though, called A Survey of Church History. It's written by, and I can give you this information if you'd like it. It's written by Don Shackelford. He has a doctorate in theology, and he's a professor at Ambridge University in Montgomery, Alabama. And this book is published by Ambridge University. It's a very good book. It's not very thick. And I'm also using this book, which is The Eternal Kingdom. It's authored by F.W. Maddox, who was the founding president of Lubbock Christian University in Lubbock, Texas. And it's also recommended by Harding University in Searcy, Arkansas, and others. This appears to be a very good book. And I commend this to anyone that would like to read further on the history of the church. I will probably use this one more than this one, and I'm not promising that I won't use other material either, but I think these are the two pieces of material that I primarily use as we go through this. This book has 33 chapters. As I've read it, there's a couple of chapters that we're not going to include. The one this morning was one that I thought we were not going to include, but I've decided to include it. But if anyone wants these, they're both available on Amazon, and I didn't check. I'll check this week. I'm pretty sure, though, that Gospel Advocate and 21st Century Christian and probably Lifeway and the other religious bookstores probably have both of these books if you wanted to drop by somewhere and pick them up. So if anybody's interested in that, just let me know, and I'll give you some more specific information written down. This morning, our lesson is entitled Historical Evidence Concerning Jesus. Now, last Lord's Day in our study of the history of the church, we covered some things. We took a brief look at the world that Jesus knew as a boy, the world that Jesus, in which he grew up. And we looked at things like the Roman government. The Roman government, Jesus lived all of his earthly life under Roman rule, and he lived all of his life under the law of Moses as a Jew, and all the things that were going on in the Roman Empire at the time had an influence on the establishment of the church and the spread of the gospel. There were some things about the Roman Empire that influenced the spread of the gospel for good. It speeded things along, and there were some things that, of course, influenced it for bad and held it up. But the conclusion was last week, and we looked at things like the Roman government, the social order of things, the moral conditions in the empire, which within the imperial administration and close around Rome were terrible. It was just horrible moral conditions. And then we also looked at the religions of the empire. We talked about some of the mysterious religions that came from the east, from Persia, and even east of Persia when Alexander the Great united the east and the west during the Grecian Empire. And then we talked about the Jewish contribution to things, which wasn't all that great because the Jews were denominational in nature by that time as well. There was a sect of the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Essenes, the Zealots, and all of these had different beliefs and different ways of acting. And then there was the Greek heritage. And this was something I was going to speak about just for a moment last week and neglected to do so because we ran out of time. But I was talking about how with each of these four great world powers, the Babylonian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Grecian Empire, and then the Roman Empire, each one of those brought something to the world of great advantage. I mentioned that the Babylonian Empire brought better farming techniques and higher tech irrigation, irrigation methods and things of this nature. The Roman Empire brought good roads and opened up the entire empire to travel and commerce. And so business flourished in the Roman Empire. And one of the reasons is because of the good roads. Another reason is something that we got from the Grecian Empire, and that was a common currency. No, the common currency was from the Romans. What we got from the Grecian Empire was a common language. And it was a very exact language, and it was a very precise language. We might mention this in the next hour just a little bit. For instance, and we've talked about this before, but our English word for love is really the only word we have in the English language that describes the emotions that we feel of love. In the Greek language, there's no less than four Greek words, and each one of those are very specific. This is the reason sometimes we like to go back and look at the original language when we're looking at a verse, because it was written, the New Testament was written in the Greek language, and the Greek language is a very precise language, in that the words in the original language sometimes had a very narrow and specific meaning and not as broad as it is in the English language. And of course, the Greek language is much, much older than the English language and had more time to mature. But the conclusion was that the world was so completely ready for the coming of the church, and because there was peace, there was good roads, there was extensive travel and commerce, there was an exact language that was known and used throughout the empire. Most of the Jews in Judea probably spoke to each other in their Hebrew language, but most of them could also communicate in the Greek language, so they were able still to do that. But it was the fullness of time. In Galatians chapter 4, verse 4 and 5, Paul said, "But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons." And there's been things that was revealed to us and revealed to people with the advent of the New Testament that weren't revealed to those under the patriarchs or under Moses' law. And it says in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 5, says that these things has not been revealed to other generations of the sons of men. So when we look back on the Old Testament history, we can see much deeper, and we can see with much more acuity than those people could see looking presently and looking forward. But I debated on whether to get into this subject or not, but because I don't like to use other books other than Bible or Bible-related books. But I thought that it might be good, because there's so many people that as they've studied the Bible, and I found myself guilty of this in the past, and I've tried to break out of that and look at the world around when these things were taking place and see what was going on. But there's so many people that I've talked with that they have kind of a subconscious feeling that the things that we read about in the Bible only existed there in the pages of the Bible. So I think it's good as we start this study, and next week we are going to look at the day of Pentecost and the establishment of the church. But it's good to look at some of the external evidences of the historicity, that is a word, the historicity of Jesus as the Christ, the fact that He was known, He did walk. But because if there was no historical evidence that He was born of a virgin, that He lived, that He worked miracles in front of so many people, that He was crucified on a Roman cross, that He was buried, that He rose again, in 3 days that he appeared to his apostles in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and appeared to over 500 people at once. If these things never happened, then we are, as Paul said, of all men most to be pitied. And so we need to look and see that these things happen. In Acts chapter 26, Paul was making his defense before Herod, the king, and Festus, the procurator of Judea, was there present. And he was talking and bringing Herod up to all of the things that had happened and one thing and another. And he got to the resurrection of the Lord. And Festus said, "Oh, Paul, you are mad." And Paul said, "I am mad, O most excellent Festus." He said, and in verse 26, he said, "For the king, before whom I also speak freely, knows these things. For I am convinced that none of these things escapes his attention, since this thing was not done in a corner." Talking about the death, the crucifixion, the burial, and the resurrection of our Lord. This thing was not done in a corner. It was the fullness of time, and in the fullness of time, everything was ready, and there was no time better for God to complete this with his Son, to complete our salvation, than the Friday before Passover the next day. Because Acts chapter 2 tells us that there were Jews from all over the Roman Empire. It enumerates the provinces, Bithynia, Pontus, all these places. There were Jews in Jerusalem. And so these things were done in front of the eyes of the world. And there was not anything done in the corner. But there were respected writers of the day, both Jewish and pagan, none of them who were members of the church at this time, but they wrote about Jesus. And I want us to see this morning some of the things that they wrote. They wrote extensively regarding Jesus, regarding James, his brother, and his death, regarding John the Baptist and the crucifixion, as well as the destruction of Jerusalem. The first one I want us to look at is a Jewish fellow by the name of Josephus, Flavius Josephus. And a lot of people quote from the works of Josephus. I've got a volume. It's about that thick, and it's about that tall, and it's the complete works of Flavius Josephus. He was a disbelieving Jew, as a matter of fact, which I think lends more credibility to the things that he wrote, because he didn't believe that Jesus was the Christ. He was one of the Jews that was still waiting for the Messiah to come. But he was born about 37, 38 A.D. When he was about 26 years old, he went to Rome on a visit. And he was just fascinated with the beautiful city, all the Roman soldiers dressed up in their garb, and all of the pomp and pageantry and circumstance and everything. And so he spent a lifetime trying to improve the relationship between the Roman government and the Jews, which was never very good, and he didn't do so well at that. But he was an intellectual and a brilliant writer, and he became so respected by the Romans that when Titus, who was the commander of the Roman forces in 70 AD that attacked the city of Jerusalem and destroyed it, he was with Titus, and he was traveling with him. As a matter of fact, one of his works is the history of the Jewish wars, I believe it's called. I've got it right here. Probably not going to put my finger right on it now that I said that. The history of the Jewish wars, that's it, in which he gives us a pretty much blow-by-blow of the attack of the Romans on Jerusalem and the destruction of the city at that time. But he wrote about Jesus, and I want us to look at this. And I'm going to read some from this book that I'm using, and it's called The Eternal Kingdom, The History of the Church. But concerning Jesus, Josephus says, "At that time lived Jesus, a wise man, if he may be called a man, for he performed many wonderful works. He was a teacher of such men as received truth with pleasure. he drew over to him many Jews and Gentiles. This was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the instigation of the chief men among us, had condemned him to the cross, they who before had conceived an affection for him did not cease to adhere to him. For on the third day he appeared to them alive. Again, the divine prophets, having foretold these and many other wonderful things concerning him, and the sect of the Christians so called from him, subsist to this time. Now, there are many scholars that believe that this is not actually a work of Josephus, because the words that I just read do not sound much like a disbelieving Jew at all. But credence is given to this passage in the fact that every manuscript of the works of Josephus, this is included in the manuscript, and it's been quoted many times by other Roman and Jewish intellectuals of the day, such as a fellow by the name of Eusebius and some other people at that time. But one of the manuscripts of Josephus, there was the description of a tumult or of a hoorah that was made on account of Jesus. And the statement reads this: at that time a man appeared, if he can be called a man. His nature and his body were human, but his appearance was more than human. He performed miracles through some invisible power. Some said of him that he was our first lawgiver, Moses, risen from the dead and making himself known by many healings and magic works. Others thought that he was sent by God. I personally, in view of his whole life, should not call him a messenger from God. Now, this was a disbeliever that read that. And so many people thought that if this man was truly from God, God would never have allowed him to have been hung on a Roman cross and killed and buried in the ground. But that was prophecy. And Josephus knew that because he knew well the Old Testament prophecy. He was a Jew, and he had heard it all his life. He said, describing the death of James, but this younger Annas, now if you look at Acts chapter 4, you'll see that Annas was, in fact, a high priest at this time in Acts chapter 4 and verse 6. And in John chapter 18, when Jesus was first arrested in the garden, it says there that they led him away first to Annas. Annas and Caiaphas were the high priests at this time. So he said, but this younger Annas, who took the high priesthood, was a bold man in his temper and very insolent. When therefore he thought he now had a proper opportunity to exercise his authority, he assembled the Sanhedrin and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who is called the Christ, whose name was James, and some other. When he had formed an accusation against them, he delivered them to be stoned. So we have an account, and all of these accounts, I want to say too, from all four of these writers, perfectly match the New Testament accounts of these things. You can find nothing wrong in any of them. In referring to John the Baptist, Josephus says, but some of the Jews were of the opinion that God had suffered Herod's whole army to be destroyed as a just punishment for him for the death of John, called the Baptist. For Herod had killed him, who was a just man, and had called upon the Jews to be baptized to practice virtue, exercising both justice toward men and piety toward God. For so would baptism be acceptable to God if they made use of it, not for the expiation of their sins, but for the purity of the body, the mind being first purified by righteousness. That's about the best explanation I've ever heard of what John's baptism was. It wasn't about salvation. The church hadn't been established yet. Christ hadn't been crucified yet. There was no salvation. There was no forgiveness of sins. So he was preaching against sin and saying, this is sin and you need to repent. That was unto repentance. And that's what Josephus so brilliantly states here, that it wasn't for the expiation or the forgiveness of their sins, but for the purity of the body, the mind being first purified by righteousness. And then he goes on to talk about that. That passage has been accepted as genuine by religious scholars all over and has been quoted by so many of them. The next one that I want to look at is Tacitus, Publius Cornelius Tacitus. He lived from A.D. 56 until after 117 A.D. He was a Roman senator and a historian of the Roman Empire. The surviving portions of his two major works was something called the Annals and the Histories. And in the Annals and the Histories, he covers the reigns of the Roman emperors Tiberius, Claudius, Nero, and those who reigned in the year of the four emperors, A.D. 69, which those emperors were Galba, Otho, Vitellius, and Vespasian. There were four emperors that reigned that year. But these two works span the history of the Roman Empire from the death of Claudius Caesar in A.D. 14 through the destruction of Jerusalem, the beginning of the Roman-Jewish wars in A.D. 70. And an interesting thing about Tacitus is that he had a strong dislike for Christians. He thought we were intentional troublemakers. There are many in our society today that share that same feeling, that Christians are intentional troublemakers and all we do is stand in the way of them being able to do the things that they want to do. There may be some truth to that. But I think that, like Josephus, that this feeling of dislike for Christians probably just strengthens his testimony, because like Josephus, his testimony is right in line with New Testament teachings, and we'll look at some of those things. I'm not going to read everything that's here, but in discussing the life of Nero and the accusation that he burned the city in 64 A.D., Nero, the Roman emperor, apparently set fire to the part of Rome and destroyed a great deal of the outward areas of the city. I don't know if he went crazy or had a lapse of judgment or exactly what it was, but he realized right away that he was in a heap of trouble, and so he accused Christians of having burnt the city. And it is to that that Tacitus is talking here, and Tacitus's ultimate understanding is that the Christians, of which so many were executed for this crime, were not guilty of the crime. The Christians had nothing to do with burning the city. But Tacitus says, "But neither all human help, nor the liberality of the emperor, nor all the atonements presented to the gods availed to abate the infamy he lay under, having ordered the city," and when he says the city, that is none other than Rome, "to be set on fire. To suppress, therefore, this common rumor, Nero procured others to be accused and inflicted exquisite punishment upon these people who were in abhorrence for their crimes and were commonly known by the name of Christians. They had their denomination from Christus, Jesus Christ, who in the reign of Tiberius was put to death as a criminal by the procurator Pontius Pilate." It goes on to say that this was a pernicious superstition, and it says, "though checked for a while, broke out again and spread not only over Judea, but the source of this evil, but reached the city, Rome, also, and to all quarters of the empire," it said. And we're going to think about that again in just a minute. He says that their executions, and I skipped some text, their executions were so contrived as to expose them to derision and contempt. Now, this is a historical account here. Tacitus wrote a history book. This is a history book of the day, and it's factual. "Some were covered with skins of wild beasts and torn to pieces by dogs. Some were crucified. Others, having been daubed over with combustible materials, were set up as lights in the nighttime and thus burned to death. Nero made use of his own gardens as a theater upon this occasion and also exhibited the diversions of the circus. That's capitalized there. I didn't look into what that means exactly. But it goes on to say that that the people were exhilarated by these spectacles at first, but it says that after a while they began to be commiserated as people who were destroyed, not out of regard to the public welfare, but only to gratify the cruelty of one man. So the people of Rome were starting to turn against Nero because they realized that this was just out of cruelty that this was being done. But from this, from these works of Tacitus, we can see seven things. Number one, that Christ is the founder of the congregation called Christians. Now, Tacitus irrespectfully called it a denomination of Christians. There is a reason for that, and we talked about this when we were studying the book of Revelations, and I think back in the study of the book of Acts, that as the Roman armies were going out and conquering nations, conquering countries, bringing them into the empire, in order to establish peace and goodwill among men, they would accept whatever religions there were in those areas and among those people. But they had some rules. They said you couldn't go out and proselyte. That flew right in the face of Christians. And one of the things that got them in trouble right off is because that's one of the fundamental tenets of the Christian religion, is that we're supposed to seek and save those who are lost. We are supposed to go out and proselyte new members. And but they allowed the Christians, when the Christians started up, the Jews, the imperial administration, recognized the Christians as an offshoot of Judaism. And so they allowed it. But then they realized that Christianity was not an offshoot of anything. It wasn't a denomination of anything. And Colossians chapter 2 tells us that Jesus took that law of Moses, Judaism, took it out of the way, nailing it to the cross. Said it was a handwriting of ordinances that was against us, that was contrary to us, and he took it out of the way. So Christianity was a brand new religion. It wasn't a denomination of anything. Number two, we learn that Christ was put to death as a criminal by Pontius Pilate, which is what we believe in the New Testament. Number three, the death took place while Tiberius was emperor. Therefore, Jesus must have been born under the reign of Augustus Caesar, which is what the New Testament teaches. Number four, Christianity, this pernicious superstition, began in Judea and was suppressed for a time, but broke out again and reached Rome before Tacitus wrote the Annals. It shows us that this is number five, that Christians were persecuted in Rome as early as 64 AD. So it started very early. Number six, vast multitudes of Christians were executed to gratify the cruelty of one man, the Emperor Nero. And number seven, as I mentioned earlier, Tacitus recognized that the Christians were innocent of the crimes that were charged against them, that they never set fire to the city. And that's what all this was about. Moving right along, there was another writer that I don't have too much about, but he was mentioned in this book, Suetonius. He was born in 88 AD, and he was a friend of Pliny the Younger. Pliny is the last one that I'm going to talk about this morning, but he wrote a book, a history book called The 12 Caesars. And they were called like the life of Claudius, the life of Tiberius, the life of Nero, the life so on and so forth. And The Life of Claudius, he says that because the Jews at Rome caused continuous disturbances and instigation of Christus, who was Jesus Christ, he expelled them from the city. Well, this passage undeniably confirms what we see in Acts 18 and verse 2, that Claudius commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome. In Acts 18 and verse 2, this is when Paul went to Corinth, and it tells us that he found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome. So Suetonius gives credence to what we find in the New Testament, or the New Testament gives credence to what Suetonius said, whichever way you want to look. And Paul came to them. And this also proves that there were Christians in Rome as early as Claudius Caesar. And in the life of Nero, whose reign began in 54 and ended in 68, Suetonius says that punishments were also inflicted on the Christians, a sect professing a new and mischievous religious belief. By the word new there, it confirms that the church was established in the time and place that set forth in the New Testament. Now I'm going to move on to Pliny the Younger. He was an interesting fellow, and he unwittingly gave testimony about the life of Christ and about the conduct of the church in those days. He was born in 61 A.D., and in 112 A.D., when Trajan was the Roman emperor, Trajan sent Pliny the Younger. He's called Pliny the Younger. There's also Pliny the Elder, who was his uncle. And Pliny the Elder was actually killed. He was a naval officer, and he was actually killed trying to save someone that was friends of his right off the coast of Pompeii after the eruption of Mount Vesuvius that destroyed Pompeii and Herculaneum, whatever the other city is. As a matter of fact, Pliny the Younger saw the eruption of Mount Vesuvius from a distance, and he was the one that reported to the imperial administration in Rome of what had happened to the cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum. But Trajan dispatched him as propraetor to the province of Bithynia. Now, that's kind of like a proconsul or a governor, but it's not exactly either. The propraetor acted below a consul and primarily had mostly judicial responsibilities. He heard a lot of arguments. He found when he went to Bithynia, he found that there were many, many Jews or many, many Christians there. So he wrote a letter to Trajan, the emperor, and asked him how he should deal with them. He said that he wasn't present at any of the trials of Christians, so he didn't know what any of their customary punishments or investigations were. He tells of their great moral integrity and unknowingly gives historical evidence concerning Christ. He knew that the Christians were dealt with capitally, but he wasn't sure if there was any deference given to age or if a weaker person might get less punishment than someone that was more robust. And he asked him these things. Pliny says in his letter to the emperor, he says, "It is my rule, sire, to refer to you any matters where I am uncertain, for who can better direct my hesitation or instruct my ignorance? I was never present at any trial of Christians, therefore I do not know what are customary penalties or investigations and what limits are observed." And he goes on and talks a little more about that. And he says, "Meanwhile, this is the course that I have adopted in the case of those brought before me as Christians. I ask them if they are Christians. If they admit it, I repeat the question a second and third time. threatening capital punishment. If they persist, I sentence them to death. For I do not doubt that whatever crime it may be to which they have confessed, their pertinacity and inflexible obstinacy should certainly be punished. There were others who displayed a like madness in whom I reserved to be sent to Rome. And so on and so forth. And so he talks about the punishment, but he gives a lot more detail than some others. He goes on to talk about the entire letter should actually, it's worthy of being studied. But in the interest of time, we've got like 60 more seconds here. And whatever I haven't covered, we're going on to the next lesson this week, and we're not going to do this anymore. But he said in one place, others named by the informer first said that they were Christians and then denied it, declaring that they had been but were so no longer, some having recounted 3 years or more before and one or two as long as 20 years. They all worshiped your image and the statues of the gods and cursed Christ. Now he brought in images of the emperor and statues of the other Roman deities that were acceptable to see if the people would bow down to them and worship them as a test to see if they had really recanted or not. Back up just a little bit. It says that, I had ordered to be brought forward for this purpose together with the statues of the deities, and especially because they cursed Christ, a thing which it is said genuine Christians cannot be induced to do. So it was a test that he gave them. But it said that they all worshiped your image and the statues of the gods and cursed Christ. But they declared that the sum of their guilt or error had amounted only to this, that on an appointed day, which would have been the first day of the week, they had been accustomed to meet before daybreak and to recite a hymn antiphonally to Christ as to a god. I looked that up. You probably, Rick, know what an antiphon, but that's where you have like two groups in the assembly and one of them will either recite and chant or sing something, and then the other group will respond back with a chant or some other singing or something. But they recited a hymn antiphonally to Christ as to a god, and to bind themselves by an oath, not for the commission of any crime, but to abstain from theft, robbery, adultery, and breach of faith, and not to deny a deposit when it is claimed. After the conclusion of this ceremony, it was their custom to depart and meet again to take food, but it was ordinary and harmless food. No doubt was the Lord's Supper, but Pliny, in his ignorance of Christianity, didn't realize that that was the food they were eating. So that's an actual eyewitness account of a first century worship service of Christians. Why did they meet on the first day of the week before dawn? Because they were afraid to meet in the daylight. So they met probably early in the morning on the first day. Our time is up, and as I said, I'm not going to belabor this subject anymore. I think it's good to look at these things and see that at the time these were going on, that there was external evidences of all of the things that we read about in the New Testament, and to look at some of these things. And next week, for sure, we will go on to the next lesson, which is going to be the establishment of the church. And at the next hour, you'll be able to find out what September the 7th is. Everybody wants to know. Thank you very much.